enjoying your holidays? I am as well. Thank you so much for making it a great year. Thanks for sharing the news with a friend, because you are our advertisement. You tell the people about us and keep us going. Geez, I don't know what we're coming on our fifth year now, and it's all because you guys listen. It's all because you go to adamcarolla.com and click through the Amazon banner and buy the Mangria, and most importantly, share with a friend. One of the most interesting guests I've spoke to in recent years, Wyclef Jean.
This is Corolla Digital. From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Today, Adam sits down one-on-one with Wyclef Jean. And now, Wyclef's former running mate, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. Welcome to the program. Thanks for coming in, Wyclef.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, man.
I know you love cars. I love cars. We can talk about that. And a couple of few. It reminded me, I was with K-Rock, the radio station, for many years.
Yes.
I remember, I think around 96, when the Fugees were playing the Weenie Roast, that big deal over at Irvine Meadows.
Uh-huh.
And I remember there was a situation, and tell me if I'm screwing this up, or if you remember this.
Uh-huh.
But what they do is they put on like 18 acts over the course of an entire day, and everyone just gets stoned and drunk and sunburned.
Uh-huh.
And at the end, Kiss plays or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is because if they go past midnight, they get fined like $5,000 a second or something like that.
Uh-huh.
They have a turning revolving stage. And while one band is on front doing a 20-minute set or a 25-minute set, the other band is setting up.
Mm-hmm.
And the second they're done with, it literally just turns and the other band is playing. And they turn that stage every 20 minutes, whether you're on it or not,
mm-hmm.
or whether you're one song in or you're at the end. They turn it because at 4 in the afternoon, if they get back 20 minutes, mm-hmm. they're back 20 minutes the entire mm-hmm. show, and they don't give a shit mm-hmm. what's going on. And the Fugees were late or something, mm-hmm. and the Fugees went out and started playing a song, and about halfway through the song, they just started turning
the thing around. I do remember that.
Now, I know, were you pissed? Was there a situation?
We didn't have a Green Day moment,
where
we was like, breaking guitars. But definitely pissed, yeah, of course.
I was at the same concert a year later, maybe that year,
mm-hmm.
and Green Day was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the guys from Third Eye Blind
mm-hmm.
ran out on stage and pretended to hug the bass player like he was a fan.
Uh-huh,
He was like, oh, he got up on stage.
Yeah.
But he was just goofing around because, you know, the bands hang around and watch the other bands from the side of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, their huge Samoan bodyguard didn't know who the dude was, and he started beating the shit out of him. And then later on, while he was beating the shit out of him, the bass player turned around from Green Day, looked at him, and I thought he was going to tell his bodyguard back off, and he mm-hmm. just kicked him.
Wow.
And then the dude just waited out by the trailers in the back with a bottle, and when the Green Day guy walked off stage, he whacked him in the head with the bottle and sent him to the hospital, like 18 stitches.
Wow.
Yeah. So
the good old days.
The good old days. So how did it all get started for you? And by the way, the book is called Purpose, and it's an immigrant story. And you came here from Haiti at age 9?
Yeah, I came from Haiti when I was 9 years old. I grew up in the projects of Brooklyn first.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a Christian minister, like of Protestant faith.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a lot of missionaries at the time that came around in the church. So his whole thing was church music. So Christian rock.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time I was growing up with like bands like Petra,
mm-hmm.
Stryper
and
different bands like that. And And on the other side, I just wanted to be a rapper. So whatever he said that rap music was devil music, drug dealer music.
Didn't they know that? You can't tell a kid that's devil
music.
Can't
tell a teenager.
Did he not see Footloose? Don't you know how the story ends? If you say anything is the work of the devil, the kid's going to be twice as into it, right?
Exactly. So I definitely got into it.
Yeah.
Man.
They should have said, like, if you don't want your young kid to do something, you go, oh, that's the music of the golfer. A lot of white dudes I know who golf dig that music, man. And then you'd go, fuck that shit. I'm singing about the Lord.
I would have did something else. Yeah, man.
So your dad, you grow up. What's going on in Haiti? I don't know anything about Haiti other than it's poor.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Haiti is that the poor part of Haiti is when you see Haiti, all you see is Port-au-Prince. But the actual country itself, it's like going to Jamaica.
Right.
But the only part, I would say Haiti's worst enemy is the PR that it has. But it has beautiful white beaches or it's similar. I don't know if you've been to the DR, the Dominican Republic.
No, I've been to Jamaica, though.
Yeah, but you know about the Dominican Republic.
Sure.
So Dominican Republic and Haiti is the same island.
Right.
The only thing that separates it is a guard.
Really?
Yes.
No, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, man. So the same beaches you got on one side, you have on the other side. After the earthquake, though, we have a new president in place. Mm-hmm. And his whole thing is just getting rid of the tents right now.
Right.
And this is something that he's been working on and putting the kids back to school.
And, I mean, there's I don't know, like I said, I know you have tourism, or you could have tourism.
Yeah, you had
you
a lot.
You could have more tourism.
You had a lot of tourism.
Right.
In the country, a lot of tourism back in the days. But what happens is, you said you don't know a lot about that country. Bill Clinton is in Haiti, like every couple of months he's down there. And I would say, so in America, there's something when you want to travel, there's a travel guide, and there's these things that pop up. Hey, you're going here, you're going on your own risk. You're going here, you're going. So whenever Haiti pops up, it's always, the mandate that pops up is, look, man, you're going on your own risk. I think one of the things that can help is to raise that mandate because the place is getting better.
Right. And so what you do, I mean, because I don't know how Haiti is fixed for natural resources and exporting tea, or I don't know what their big crop is, or I don't know what they're sitting on, a bunch of oil or anything. But I do know people would go down there and lay around on the beach and spend a bunch of money at restaurants if they felt like it was safe to do so.
Definitely, 100%. Back in the days when Haiti was at its prime, it's called the Pearl of the Caribbean, and it was known for exporting coffee and sugar to a great portion of the world. But to your point, right now we have some of the finest beaches, but until that mandate get raised and people feel like it's safe, like anywhere, like there's a lot of people that's like, I ain't going to Mexico no more, you know?
Right.
Because of what's going on.
Well, what and who is in charge of that, like, parole hearing? I mean, you have to go, look, we've had under X amount of murders and under X amount of purse snatches and under X amount of car stolen. Like, who decides at a certain point to lift that ban?
I mean,
that's not a ban, but I mean, lift that warning, which freaks out a lot of people who are traveling.
I mean, that warning would have to do with the U.S. It would have to do with the team lobbying to Washington to showing exactly where the country is at. Remember, at one time, Jamaica was at its worst, you know, and then they started throwing the commercials, go back to Jamaica, and started showing the beaches. But a lot of that lobbying has to do with going to Washington, because a lot of tourists that do travel are Americans. Americans like going all over the place. So they would like to know they're going to a safe place.
Yeah. Did you see that Bob Marley documentary?
Yes, I did. Yeah, man,
that was awesome.
Yeah, loved it. I learned a lot.
I did too.
And I love I'm a Marley freak.
I didn't know his dad was a white dude. I didn't even know that much about the guy. I didn't know anything about him. But it seemed those days Jamaica seemed a little turbulent.
Oh yeah, big time, very very turbulent. But turned around though, turned itself around. Yeah.
Well, again, you get the tourism going, people start making money, they stop stealing, and everything mellows out. But your journey, back to your journey. So you leave with your dad and your mom and your whole family. I'm guessing.
No, my father left me in Haiti. I was born in a hut,
Like
straight up in a hut. Used to take a donkey to school.
Wow.
Water takes 3 miles. If you ever see the setting of the story Slumdog Millionaire, the beginning of that movie, That's sort of like how the hut looked.
Do you have kids?
I have one daughter.
Great.
And every time I tell her,
I took a donkey to school.
She says, no, Daddy, you didn't take no donkey to school.
I took a donkey to school. You know what you end up getting? I'm going to get the, you know what you're going to, she's going to hold it against you because she's going to go, donkey, that's cool, man. Because I saw that Shrek movie. That sounds fucking awesome, Dad. My problem is I used to work construction. I had to eat off a lunch truck my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I was planning on saving that story for my kids. You know, I had to eat off a lunch truck, but now they have my kids are going to be like, oh, the Kobe beef lunch truck,
yeah,
or the Mr. Sprinkle soft swirl. Like, no, lunch trucks,
yeah,
real
lunch trucks.
Shitty lunch, yeah, trucks, like, uh-huh, back in the day lunch, yeah, trucks, not cool lunch trucks.
That's
that,
right,
you're used to now. Wow, rode a donkey to school.
Man, yeah, it went from the donkey my dad left me when I was 1 year old,
mm-hmm,
and he came to America because the Church of the Nazarene gave him a visa.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes to America and he gets a 6-month visa.
Mm-hmm.
And after the visa expires, he basically goes underground. At that time, the immigration laws were quite different, you know.
Right.
If you had a kid within the United States, automatically the child became a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So he had 2 kids here,
mm-hmm,
in the States, then came back to Haiti and got us.
Was he still married to your mom?
Yeah, he brought my mama over.
Well, how'd your mom feel about him having the 2 kids?
No, with my mom. He brought my mom
over. Good. Good. Okay. Just want to make sure everything was cool.
Yo.
So, well, listen, I saw that Bob Marley documentary. You know, he did a little of that.
Yeah.
But he's still a legend.
It was with my mom.
Oh, okay, good. So now you come over on a donkey or you take a boat?
No. We came over. You know what's crazy is, when you say in a donkey, beyond the donkey, in the book, I talk about the fact that me and my brother ate red dirt from the floor. And my brother is a lawyer today in California.
Really?
And I tell people, like, when you say dirt poor, the idea of picking dirt from the floor and eating that.
Now, I mean, really, what is red dirt? Is it dirt with blood in it? What is
it? It's like this, you know, in the book we call it like a mineral dirt, but it's literally like sometimes as a kid in the village, you know, you feel, mm-hmm, like you don't got nothing to eat.
Right.
And you're so hungry, you literally would take the dirt from the floor and eat it.
Just to feel something in your belly.
Just to feel something in your stomach. I mean, that was extreme. So when my dad came to get us, was bringing us to America, keep in mind, I didn't see no electricity before, nothing. I didn't even have a clue what lights were,
right,
besides the sun.
Right.
You feel me?
Yeah. So, that's crazy. So, I mean, it's like it really from 0 to 9 years of age, you could have been born in any time period in the world. Like,
yeah,
you could have been born in 1000 BC. It would not matter. Same, yeah, life. Dirt on the floor, donkey, chauffeur donkey, eating dirt, no sun, no electricity.
Yeah, and then you look at the sky, you could see east, west, depending on where the sun is pending.
Right.
You would know where to go. So that was the extreme,
right,
of 1 to 9. My grandfather was a voodoo priest,
mm-hmm,
in Haiti. Like, so
makes sense. One out of every 2 grandfathers is over there,
right? So
your grandfather's a voodoo. Oh, my grandma. Whose grandfather is not a voodoo priest? Nobody. Wow. Okay. So
one out of every 2. No, it's man, I just remember, man.
So your dad sends for you. You go over there,
but the taking that airplane. Like, can you imagine going from that hut and then when I'm getting on an airplane?
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's a UFO. It looks,
right,
like a giant bird at the time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, freaky. Yeah, you go from zero technology to modern.
I've never seen white people before.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll freak you out.
Listen. So the only time I've seen, and we call them Les Blancs, so it was like living in the time of the Indians. You know, mm-hmm, what I'm saying? So you say, hey, the white man is coming now.
Right.
They would always come to the village, bring the rice.
Right.
So once in a while, you get the rice. So when we get on the plane,
yeah,
it looks like we're on a UFO. And,
right,
I can't speak English.
Right.
So everything sounds like alien language to me.
Sure.
Hello, how you doing?
Yeah. We are here to bring you something whiter than us.
Yeah.
It's called rice. Enjoy.
And you're looking like, you know, so that was the extreme of landing in the United States.
So now, what was your impression of people from the United States? Because at the beginning, you only knew them as white people. You knew them as the people that brought the rice.
Yeah, because keep in mind, what I'm doing is I'm taking you into the mind of a Haitian in the village. And when we say white people, it's the same as Indian people at the time. So I'm taking you to primitive time, like if we was talking in the village,
sure.
As I take you back. Because, you know, my family has white and black people. So mm-hmm. I want to explain when I say de blanc. So we call them les blancs.
Mm-hmm.
So when we came...
Like blanco, like white.
Yeah. So when we came to the United States, the idea of coming to the States was you was coming to the city of diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that you wanted to be and accomplish, if you got to this place, you can accomplish it.
Right.
That was the idea.
Now, how did you feel then? I mean, because it's interesting because I watched the DNC and the RNC and all that kind of stuff, and you know, we do a lot of, let's face it, the game is rigged and it's stacked against you and you can't make it, and I think that's a bad message to send to people. I feel like your brother's an attorney, right?
Yes, sir.
You have a DeLorean. Yeah. You came here with nothing but red dirt in your pockets and a donkey, and you're doing good. Now, the thing is, I always say, like, well, we could be better, no doubt about it, but I think where you're from, you really can't make it. I mean, that's hard. That's a much taller order. For someone like your brother, let's say, who's a successful attorney, this is a good place for him to make it. It's not a perfect place, and it's still got its problems, but it's better than most places, hence your brother the attorney, right?
Well, yeah, the place where I'm from, 80% of the population is living on less than $2 a day. The majority of the population is not employed. And then that brother, though, the one that's a lawyer, he was in Haiti with me.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, though, is when we came to America, coming from where we came from, everything looked like we landed in the projects and we felt like we was rich already.
Well, the notion of a toilet and running water and a light bulb and an oven to somebody from a civilization that could have, like I said, been 1,000 years old, that's a big deal. I mean, we have a kind of a poor in this country, which is you only have two TV sets, or you and your wife have to share a car, but we don't have a real poor. Mm-hmm. We don't have the kind of poor that you knew mm-hmm. growing up. We have a kind of a poor, which is, you know, our poor is not that poor. I mean, I know there's plenty of poor people in this country, and mm-hmm. I used to be poor too, so I understand, you know, welfare and food stamps and mm-hmm. all that shit. But still, there was a TV set. You know, mm-hmm. it was black and white, and it was 13 inches, but we had a TV set, you mm-hmm. know, and we had running water, and our bathroom was inside, not outside. Mm-hmm. And we don't understand the kind of poverty that some of these other nations have and what poor is over there. I mean, mm-hmm. our poor here would be middle class and then some in Haiti, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you took you hit it on the dot when you said, like, you know, you have toilet, you have running water, you have electricity. That alone changes the idea of being in a hut.
Yeah. So you come over here at 9, and all, by the way, chronicled in the book called Purpose, An Immigrant Story. And your dad's preaching, and you're living in the projects, and when do you have your first taste of success?
For first taste of success, of course, you know, for us, there's a lot of stories about we always start off in the church, you know. I would say being in the projects, I got introduced, my brother once bought a CD. It was The Police,
mm-hmm.
Synchronicity.
Mm. Yeah, don't yell too loud about The Police and the projects. People are
scattered. Pink Floyd.
Ooh.
So we was like the weird kids in the
sure.
projects.
Because well, also your accent must have freaked everyone out because you didn't look any yeah. different.
Well, your accent and you're listening to Bob Dylan. So the right. two just didn't get along at the time.
Right.
But we loved rock and we loved hip hop. first taste of success came with my group, the Fugees.
Sure.
The CD was done in my uncle's basement. I did the whole CD in my basement because my dad had kicked me out the church.
Mm-hmm.
And the CD was called The Score.
Your dad kicked you out of the church because you were playing the devil's music?
Yeah, I was playing the devil's music, according to him at the time. Mm-hmm. So basically, I went to my uncle's house that was in the hood, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is now it's the next chapter of my life, right? So you have, we're in the hood. We got the pit bulls in the back.
Sure.
We got the garage. Behind the garage is the crack house.
Mm-hmm.
We're in East Orange, New Jersey now.
Mm-hmm.
And we in this basement. And just started recording The Score. And I would say after we did The Score, we went to Europe. And when we was in Europe, we got the call from Sony Music. And they was like, yo, y'all like numbers something on the charts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't hit us because we was touring.
Right, right.
And an idea of a CD that was produced in my uncle's basement to have sold over 20 million copies, it didn't hit us because while the success was moving, we was constantly moving.
Right.
The first time it hit me was when I got to the Grammys.
Right.
And
that
would have
been
perform.
In 92?
No, performed at the Grammys 96.
Right. Oh, 96. Yeah. So you guys formed, had been around, been playing around. And, oh, yeah, that's right, because that was a big year. That was Roberta Flack song. That, right?
Yeah, we had Killing Me Softly. And
right.
But
that's
the Fugees started in the early
90s. That's a weird song to cover.
Yeah, it's... It was weird when, for us, coming from hip-hop, right?
Right.
Now, Lauren being, of course, an R&B connoisseur and loving R&B, loving Roberta Flack, in a sense of like a hip-hop group about to cover Killing Me Softly, that just don't mix with the two, you know?
Well, it sounds like the kind of thing you could do if you wanted to, but it doesn't sound like the kind of thing that's going to sell any tickets or get any spins on radio. It's a great song. It's from the 70s. It's very slow and it's a little depressing and it's a weird 70s song. That's a good song, but no one would ever think, let's remake that song. It's a crazy song to remake.
Yeah. Now, as a producer, I'm a big fan of Quincy Jones, so I hear music a little differently in my head. So what I did was I said, we're going to dumb it down, just rock drums. And Lauren's vocals is just incredible against it. And I said, we're going to put a bass line. Mm-hmm. To your point, we didn't take that song that seriously. That's why when the song starts off, I'm like, yo, this is why I clap. You know, I got my boy. And
you didn't think that was going to be a hit.
No, the song that you don't take seriously usually is the one that ends up blowing up.
That's what I tell my kids all the time. Yeah. Listen, be glad I'm not paying attention to you. You're going to blow up, man. If I had hopes and dreams for you, you'd probably be working at 7-Eleven. So how do you meet Lauryn Hill?
Met her through high school, my last year of high school, going into Prize, which is the other member of the group, gives me a call. And says, you know, I have a group with two girls. And, of course, I'm young at the time.
Sure.
And I'm like, how do girls look?
Mm-hmm.
And I basically went to the studio. And the producer at the time in the studio was a gentleman by the name of Khalees Bayon.
Mm-hmm.
He's Kool's brother. So he's the one that did Jungle Boogie, Celebrate Good Times, mm-hmm. Joanna, all those hits.
Sure. Kool and the Gang.
Yeah. So yeah. I went in there and I just laid my part. And he was like, man, there's a mystery and a magic going on with you guys. And that was my first time meeting Lauren and Marcy. There was two girls from the Fugees.
Mm-hmm.
One ended up leaving.
We're Lauryn Hill, by the way, just stunning looking. I mean, that chick's just got bones. Like, she's just a good-looking person, at least what I've seen of her.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Fugees get their name?
The Fugees is short for refugees.
Oh.
So we wanted to go with refugees, but there was a rock band at the time, I think on Sony,
mm-hmm.
called Refugees.
Yeah.
And we couldn't use refugees. So
you know what I like? I don't know why, but I love the fact that Better Than Ezra is called Better Than Ezra because there's a band called Ezra.
See?
And so somebody said, you can't use Ezra because like they sued them or something.
Yeah,
and they went, let's change our names to Better Than Ezra.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is funny. I don't know. It always cracks me up.
So there was like refugees we can't use. So it was okay.
So you went with Fugees. And so you got Lauryn Hill, and she's got an amazing voice. and she's very easy on the eyes, so that doesn't hurt. And you guys take this Roberta Flack song from like 1973 or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what year that song's from, but like, Michaela? Like early, mid or early 70s. And that thing just blows up. I mean, other songs as well, but that song becomes a crazy hit, and it's played all over the place. It didn't seem to have, I mean, it's not played on classic rock stations, but it seemed to jump from genre to genre in terms of, you know, radio stations. It seemed to get just tons and tons of airplay. So now the Fugees are blowing up. Is it freaking you out at all? Is your dad kissing your ass now?
No, not at all. He's just straight up still a minister asking me when I'm going to come back to church. My father never came to a Fuji concert.
Really? I mean, is there a part of you that goes, okay, he's a very devout man, and I respect that. On the other hand, I'm his son, and he should come out and support me.
Well, I mean, of course, I thought that every day. So the only concert he actually showed up, I tricked him. I told him it was a gospel concert, was when I performed at Carnegie Hall.
Right.
You know, I made that call. I had everybody come out that night. Eric Clapton, Stevie Wonder, and I was just gung-ho to see my father on the balcony and the fact that he showed up. You know?
And what did he say about it?
You know, after the show, you know, you're waiting for him to say, you know, I brought you from Haiti. You did good in America, you know?
Right.
But he said to me, he said, do you know when you make it? And I'm like, no, you know, I'm waiting for him to say. He said, when white people, black people, yellow people, green people, they come to see you and they don't see the color, they see the man, then you know you've made it in America.
Well, that must have felt pretty damn good from Pops. He didn't give it up that easily, right?
He didn't give it up that easy.
Well, you know, interesting. There's a couple things. One is, the whole, we were talking about the Bob Marley documentary. You know, he wanted more black faces in his audience. It was pretty much a bunch of white people come out and see him play. Mm-hmm. And he wanted more folks who were from where he was from or looked like him to get out in the audience. And he had to open. Now, did he open for the Commodores or something like that?
Yes.
It was a crazy story. Mm-hmm. But in terms of dads giving it up, see, you know, I'm from here, and our dads, especially now, everyone's just pussy whipped. Everyone's, my son, he's my brother, he's my light of my life, he's the greatest. You're supposed to be best friends with your son, you know.
Yeah.
You're supposed to call him buddy, you know, not son, not his name, but champ, buddy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's my buddy, and hugs and kisses. And I am that way. I have six-year-old twins. But in other countries, in other nations, I feel like the dad is a little more of a dad. Like, A, you're a little bit scared of your dad, and B, he don't do a lot of hugging and kissing on you because that's mama's job. Like, his job is to be that voice of authority, the one you respect. And maybe the guy calling you champ and hugging you and kissing you isn't what you need. And I don't know. Like, do you think if you had me as your dad, and I was just going, oh, man, I love your new song. That's give me a kiss. Give me a hug. This is awesome. Do whatever you want. Do you think maybe you wouldn't have had the fire in your belly? Like, do you think you needed that disciplinarian there?
If I had you as my dad, I probably would have been a good a race car driver.
Well, that's a good segue to talk about cars for a second. You grew up with a donkey and not a car. You probably, from 0 to 9 in Haiti, you probably didn't see a ton of cars, right? I mean, the white guy carrying the rice maybe had a Range Rover.
I didn't see no cars.
Land Rover, but no cars.
I didn't see no cars.
In
the air at times, we saw airplanes, but they were so high, we thought that they were giant birds and try to hit them down with slingshots.
So at a certain point, you start making some money,
and
you want some cars because you like cars. What's not to like about cars?
Yeah, the thing about the cars was my father worked for Don Warnock.
Wait a minute, who's Don Warnock?
It was a car company back in the days.
You mean like a dealership?
Yeah, dealership.
Like Don Warnock Ford.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, they had the Taurus, all kind of cars. Mm-hmm. My father was part of fixing the cars, the mm-hmm. mechanics on the cars. Mm-hmm. And also, he would be the guy that would drive the cars to different locations.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, Fridays, he would pick me up from school as he's going to the next location. And we would play That's My Car.
You mm-hmm. know? Pretend that's your car.
Pretend that's my car.
Right.
That's really where it really got started for me.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sense of... I went to London when I was a Fuji.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I did, I said, take me to the McLaren mm-hmm. store.
Yeah.
And but keep in mind, I'm in London. This is 94. I don't have no money.
Yeah. And now, McLaren makes F1, a lot of F1
yeah.
Engines. And then they made a car. And they made a supercar in, the, I think, 93 or 94. Yeah. And it's a crazy... It's mid-engine. You literally sit in the middle of it.
Uh-huh.
It's incredibly exotic, and they've recently now made another version of the new MC12 or whatever it is, McLaren, which is actually sort of reasonable. It's like, I don't know, $245,000 or something. It's got all carbon fiber monocoque tub and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The first one of the early 90s was... It was a fighter jet. It was the most advanced street-going car on the planet for its time.
Yeah.
But it's probably stickered for like $750,000 or something back in the, 93, 94, something. I don't know.
Yeah.
You remember?
And then to your point, the 95 edition was the last street-legal version of that car. Like, it was just too much. You know, it was like... basically an airplane on wheels.
Yeah, it's a 200-mile-an-hour car back when, there weren't too many 200-mile-an-hour cars. I don't think
on
any.
The street.
Like, on the street, yeah.
It was going for 1.1.
Dealer markup.
Yeah, dealer markup pounds. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I worked in a dealership, too, just so mm-hmm. Dealer markup. And I asked him, he said 1.1. I said, man, he said, Chop, that's, 1.1, and I said, okay. I said, I'll be back for it in 3 years. He looked at me like I was crazy. And in 3 years, I came back. And that was like my first car.
Well, I got to say, those cars, I don't know if you still have it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You do?
Yeah.
Good, because those things have gone up in value quite a bit over the last few years. And you can't say that about a lot of cars. I mean, modern-day cars. You know, if you'd bought a Ferrari in 1994, it would not be worth four times or five times as much as it's worth today. If you bought a Maranello 550, or I'm trying to think of what they had in 94, 95. Mm-hmm. But let's just say you bought a 550 Ferrari mm-hmm. in 1995. That Ferrari would have cost you $155,000, $160,000, and it'd be worth $75,000 to $100,000 mm-hmm. today. So that's a little drop.
Yeah,
this car, $1 million, probably worth $3-3.5 today. I don't know. I gotta get Jay on the line and figure it out.
Well, the car is incredible because it's sort of like the way somebody loves Basquiat, the painter,
mm-hmm.
Michelangelo. You know, at times, they feel like we're overboarding and ODing. But for me, just the architect of someone to think that far, sometimes I have a 1932 Zephyr.
Mm-hmm.
And at times I'm looking at this car and I'm like, who created this thing? What did the person have in their mind?
The thing I love about it is it was one guy, mm-hmm. but 200 guys worked on it.
Yeah.
And I love the fact, the form and the function part. I love the mm-hmm. fact that there's a bunch of engineers and artists, mm-hmm. Working together. Yeah. I love the fact that there's some woman... old Italian woman who's been working on the same mm-hmm. sewing machine, stitching the hides together, I love it. Like, I've gone to the Aston Martin factory in Gaydon outside of London, and, they're saying to you, when they're explaining to you, well, we use all our hides, all our cow hides, we contract with a special farmer, cattle rancher, and this guy's in the Netherlands, and they don't use barbed wire because it nicks up the skin, so this guy, so all our hides have no scuffs or nicks or scars on them, and then they're all sewed by these two women, and They don't mix and match. If one woman sews one car, she does the entire car because her sewing machine may be a little bit different than the other one's sewing machine, and they don't want the pattern to be any different. I love that. And I'll tell you, when you walk through one of those factories, like, you know, Ferrari, Aston Martin, something like that, you look around and you just go, well, this is what human beings can do.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When they're motivated and when they're not fighting and trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
This is what they can do. And you turn on the news and you see the latest terrorist attack or whatever's going on, wherever it's going on, ethnic cleansing, whatever's going on. And you go, what the fuck is wrong with us? Mm-hmm. And then you go to the factory of Aston Martin and you go, wow, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
So it's one of these things where if you ever get depressed, go hop on a plane and go take a tour of the Aston Martin. Because when you see the craftsmanship, when you see – and – there's a million different guys, and they all have their one department.
Yeah.
And one guy's just doing the body work, and he's old school.
No, that's incredible. I'll say for me, my greatest high was probably going to Abu Dhabi in the Ferrari city.
Yeah.
Like, that was pretty insane. Like, every Ferrari possible in the, you know, it's like going into Disneyland of Ferraris.
Yeah.
And but the fact that people love it so much that they would actually build an entire city.
Never even knew there was a Ferrari city in Abu Dhabi. Yeah, insane.
Insane, man.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what do they have? They have everything new and old, everything Ferrari?
Everything new and old from race on down. And then they even have rides. So they tie it with the themes where you can get on amusement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like an amusement park with all Ferraris.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. I was, speaking of cars, as long as we're talking about cars, I was at Bruce Meyer's place. Mm-hmm. You guys can find a picture of Bruce Meyer, Bruce Meyer's cars. This dude has, I was there today, little storefront right in the middle of Beverly Hills. Wouldn't even know it. Just a door.
Mm-hmm.
Just a door in the middle of everything. And right in the middle of Beverly Hills. And, you know, just the most crowded part of Beverly Hills. And there's just a door. That's his home garage. I think we need to find a picture of his work garage because there's more. And, you open the door and you go up some stairs and you go to the back and it was the first parking structure that was built in Beverly Hills in 1929. Mm. And now it's filled with Ferraris and Gullwing Mercedes and motorcycles and just everything under the sun. And by the way, you know, as a car collector, you know, he's pointing at the Cobra and you're going, wow, that's a nice Cobra. And he goes, yeah, this is the first one ever built. And your brain's just going, cha-ching, cha-ching. What is this, three, five? Would he take four?
Yeah.
Like, crazy what this guy has.
Yeah.
So you have, you got the Zephyr, right? You got the... You got the McLaren.
Yeah.
You going to get the new McLaren?
I looked into the new McLaren, but, you know, it's no need for that.
You can get it when you need to. I'll tell you what pisses me off. Tell me how you feel about this. I hate it when chicks, and I'm not talking about Danica Patrick. I'm talking about Paris Hilton. Mm-hmm. When I see pictures of her leaning against her Lexus LFA, I get angry because it's like she doesn't drive. She don't know how to drive that car. What's she got that? There she is in her Lexus LFA. Uh-huh. And I was driving down the street the other day and I was driving down Sunset and I pulled up on a new McLaren. And this was a few months ago. So I hadn't seen too many on the street yet. And I was like, ooh, what's that McLaren? And then I pulled up and there were like two 23-year-old chicks driving it. And I thought, what the hell? And then at the next stoplight, I was looking in on them, and one pulls up some Taco Bell.
Wow.
And she's just eating Taco Bell in her new McLaren. And I'm like, thinking, what the fuck is going on? Some guy busted his ass to make a car that would turn the Nürburgring 2 seconds faster
than
anything ever.
That's blasphemy, man.
That's what it is.
That's blasphemy, period.
Yeah.
In the car world. That's blasphemy.
Right. Could you imagine somebody eating Taco Bell in your McLaren, likely?
No, ain't going to happen.
Not going to happen, right?
Not going to happen.
So now what else do you have?
I have like I like 58 pink Cadillacs, you know. I like the
a lot
tail,
of range
the long
there.
Tail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's really cool.
Do you do events? Do you go around? Do you go to some of the shows?
When I was like younger, I had more time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's not that much time, you know. My favorite thing to do when I have little time is get one of like inside of one of my old vintage and just go through Times Square.
Mm.
Like just very, very slow, like 11:30 at night when the sun is coming down and just, you know, just cruise. That's like my favorite thing to do.
You're based on the East Coast?
Yes. I'm originally based in the East Coast and stuff. And I love bikes, too, you know.
Motorcycles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love bikes.
Yeah, I do, too. Yeah, man. So a lot of bikes on motorcycles. And it's tough when you're in New York.
Oh, yeah. It's
A, you got the weather.
Terrible.
B, you got to pay if you want to park your cars in the city.
Terrible.
I mean, it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough for dudes who like cars.
Yeah. No, a lot of my stuff now is in Miami, you know? Like, you're not going to leave a lot of it, you know?
Right.
Miami is easy. My mother's in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
So, the only bad part is I feel I just don't get enough time with the cars, you know?
Mm-hmm. So now, what, we'll step back for a second. Now, so the Fugees are blowing up, and everything's going great. And then what happens? Because I don't know if you guys broke up because you got into an argument or you just broke up because it was time to do something else.
Well, in the book, I talk about it. I talk about the heated affair, the love triangle
mm-hmm.
at the time that that I was having with Lauren
mm-hmm.
at the time of the group. And I talked about the fact that I was married at mm-hmm. the time and then being married and then I have Lauren. And I'm in the middle.
It's got to, being mm-hmm. married and going out on the road with the 22-year-old Lauryn Hill's got to be a little rough.
I mean.
In the temptation department, right?
Well, it's like you read these stories about, because before me, there was Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell. You look and you're like, no, it's not going to be me. No, it's not going to be me. I think in any situation, if you're spending a lot of time with the person.
Well, in hotel rooms.
Well, not just in the hotel rooms, because you're in the studio. So if we're
right.
in the studio, we're recording,
mm-hmm.
we're there. If we're on stage, we're performing, we're there.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the hotel, we are watching a movie, we're there.
Right.
So eventually that led into a deep passion,
mm-hmm.
which later, you know, like I say in my book, that's really what led to the breakup. I would say of the group, you know.
Because, well, hold on a second. I wonder if I should tease this. Hey, ask Dawson, ask Mike if he wants to take a quick break or just want to, no reason. All right, okay. So you have this incredible love affair with Lauryn Hill, who's in the group with you, and, you know, it's a double-edged sword because on one hand, you know, you see him all the time, and on the other hand, you see them all the time,
mm-hmm.
and you can't get away from them. And if things don't go well, it's really hard to be on stage, I'm guessing, travel mm-hmm. and work with this. I mean, not every band, but bands do it sometimes with love affairs, and then sometimes they just become the Eagles, and everyone hates each other's guts. You know what I mean? Like, something happens. There's a relationship of sorts. So you guys have this relationship. Do you divorce your wife? Do you break up with your wife?
I definitely don't divorce my wife. I stayed with her, and I stayed with Lauren at the time.
And your wife, how's your wife with this?
Oh,
not happy?
Of course not happy.
Yeah,
and,
stupid question.
Yeah, insanely not happy.
Right.
You know? But in the book, you know, you're writing a memoir, so you got to go back there and just say it raw the way it is.
Right. So your wife knows what's going on.
No, she didn't know.
Oh, she didn't know.
Nah, she didn't know. You know, one time she was like, gets me in a car. It was mm-hmm. like, you know, we got to put an end to this. Her and Lauren get in the car.
Wow.
And I talk about it in the book.
Was it the McLaren?
I'm sweating my balls. No, this is way before that.
Because that's got the center seat with the two seats on each side of it. So they could have done that.
No. Uh-huh. It was nothing like that.
You could have sat in the middle.
Well,
all right. So they get, so it's you, your wife, and Lauryn Hill in the car.
Yeah, and I have to make a decision, you feel me?
Uh-huh. And is your wife saying it's me or her, or Lauren saying it's you know, make a decision?
That's wow. how it went down.
Wow. So what'd you say?
You know, I ended up, I have a song in the my album, The Carnival, when mm-hmm. I talk about this very chapter, and I say, I'm in love with two women. Who is it going to be now?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I knew that I love my wife because of the simplicity, love being at home, and she was a go-getter too. She was modeling at the time. And then at the time, I loved being in the studio with Lauren, and I loved the music we was making, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I eventually ended up finishing the Fuji stuff, and then, you know, I was married more to my wife.
So you picked your wife over Lauren Hill?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, eventually that's what happened.
And so Lauren didn't get over that?
No, but now keep now this is where the story gets deep. So the law of karma, right? You mm-hmm. know, you just think, man, I'm going to do stuff and ain't nothing going to happen to me. You feel me?
Right.
And the part of the book that the gossip part that they pull out, because there's 8 chapters in the book and you went through all the chapters so we could talk about this, was the part when her first kid was going to be born, you know,
mm-hmm. Lawrence.
Lawrence's okay. first child. And for a while, I thought that that was my child.
Because she told you that?
Well, a combination of her telling me that and also a combination of why wouldn't it be,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the
right.
time.
Sure.
And I think that part of it, you know, when there's a kid involved, I don't get into the deepness of that. But inside of the memoir, it was important to for a Fuji fan. What is the missing piece? Because you just don't get it. You're like, what happened, Clef? Did this group break up? You know, and you just asked it. You was like, what? Because it was here and then it disappeared. What's going
right.
on? And that sort of like was the component. So once that happened, I talk about the fact that.
Well, let me just make sure we're all clear here for a second. Lauren Hill gets pregnant, or is pregnant, but this is after now you've made your decision to stay with your wife. But you're assuming that that child is your child.
Even though I'm staying with my wife, I'm still
a little back
rotating.
And forth?
Yeah, yeah,
little rotation.
Still back and
all
forth,
right.
Yes.
So then your dad would not approve of this, I don't think, right?
Of course not.
No, see what the devil music makes you do? He may have had a point. All right, just stay in the church. But now you're doing a little rotation, and you're assuming that's your kid, because if that's not your kid, then Lauren Hill's cheating on you, in a sense.
Yes, at the time and at the year,
mm-hmm.
in the early 20s, of course, just the adolescent years, you know, you're a rock star, you think everything belongs to you, period.
Right.
You know?
No, it's great being a dude, because while you're cheating on your wife, you could be yelling at the woman you're cheating with, you slut, I can't believe you're sleeping with somebody else, which is exactly what you're doing.
Of
essentially.
Course, of course, at the time, definitely.
So it ends up not being your child.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find that out?
I find that out basically by being in the hospital, you know, not there in a delivery or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just showing up, sitting down,
mm-hmm.
you know, waiting patiently, you feel me?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when the child is born, I'm clear that that's not my child. And
not riding
I
a
left.
Donkey? Wait, you mean like white dude?
Huh?
Well, it was like different color, different, just like,
I just know that. You know,
you just know.
I just knew, you know, and I left.
Well, wait a second. Hold on. Sorry. Mm. I don't know. Like, my kids, when I saw them, I really wouldn't know
mm-hmm.
they're twins. Like, I wouldn't go, oh, that's my boy and that's my girl. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't tell. But if the kid was a couple of shades off of me,
mm-hmm.
I might tell something. Is that what we're talking about? Or
Well, I just knew, you know.
You just knew?
There's
really?
Yeah, there's a feeling.
I think
feeling.
That's a Haitian thing. Because I'm from North Hollywood. We don't just know anything.
No, there's definitely a Haitian kid. I look and said, no.
Not your
you
blood.
Know? I just know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I left, you know.
And is that it? I mean, is there any Fuji reconciliation, any Fuji reunion tour? Is it? And I know there's that thing where it's like, listen, I want the best for Lauren, and maybe she says the same thing about you. But realistically, could you guys be in the same room? Could you make music? Could you go out on stage together?
Well, Dave Chappelle came and got the Fugees all back together, and we did the Dave Chappelle block party. Then we all went in the studio and attempted to try some form of reunion album.
Yeah.
The vibes just, you know, like you could just, it was just not it, you know, at the time. Just, we ain't feel it.
Yeah. Know? Well, women, they have pretty good memories.
Yes, they do.
I found my experience with women is they don't have fantastic memories when it comes to dates, like, you know, when certain battles took place in World War II and stuff like that. But if you fuck them over, they do remember that stuff pretty well.
Yeah, they remember the time, the date, the whole...
remember shitty things you said when you were drunk, even when they were drunk.
Oh, yeah.
They remember all that shit really good. Remembering where their keys and cell phone, not as important as remembering super shitty things that you may have done or said. And that stuff is always brand new. It's like they keep it in Tupperware, and it's fresh. Dudes, I do find, move on. I mean, guys who they were fighting with, they can be friends with a year down the road. Women, not so much. They hang on. So that's probably that. But you tried it. The vibe wasn't there. And you're doing your own thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a phrase that say never, right? So the possibility of the future. I've seen all kind of rock bands get back together. People was like, man, they will not get back together. You know, it's impossible.
Well, so, I mean, it's legendary. Guys throwing, having fist fights and stuff like that. And then 10 years later, well, sometimes money helps.
Yeah, but I would say in the case of the Fugees, like I told you, they was throwing all kind of money. And if the Fugees right now say they want to do a tour, they're going to throw all kind of money. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, like I tell you, like in Bono from U2, one of my favorite bands, you know, like Bono one time was talking to me. He's like, man, what's going on? You know, y'all like the Black Beatles of hip hop.
Right.
Like when I first heard y'all had the band, y'all was playing guitar, y'all was singing, you know, and he's like, for the core of the music, y'all can't stop doing that, you know?
Right.
So there's a lot of people that would want to see that, you know what I mean? I just don't see it, you know?
Yeah, well, it's one of these things that's sad because it's like, I don't know. It's like when a painter kills themselves in their 20s or something. Like, how much more work could have come out of that dude? You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you know, that's one way to look at it. Another way I looked at it is if the Fugees was going, then I probably would have never wrote the first song for Destiny Child, which became No, 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 which was a hit. I probably wouldn't have wrote Maria Maria for Carlos Santana, which became a hit. I probably wouldn't have wrote Shakira, Hips Don't Lie, which became a hit. I probably wouldn't have ran for president of my country. So there's two sides to it. I just know when you're in a band and it's more than one person, your whole focus and energy is how do you make that band better?
You wouldn't have written a book, Purpose, by the way. And I know it because I lost a radio gig. And when I lost a radio gig, I wrote a book. And I wouldn't have written a book if I was working every single day and getting up at 5 in the morning and doing it. I just would have said, I'm too busy or I can't do it. I don't know what the time is. So, I mean, yeah, one door closes and another one opens. Mm-hmm. And people don't seem to realize if you're good, one door closes and another one opens. And if you're not good, the door closes, it gets welded shut, and you never get back in the house. But, Wycliffe, you're obviously talented. So when you leave the band, you take your talent with you, and you just start applying it in different directions. And you'll always have that. And that doesn't get left behind with the Fugees. And so for you, you have this luxury of talent. And that not everyone has that luxury.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I love talent, and I love finding talent, and I love discovering people, you know. But my range really, you know, I remember when I was doing my video for Gone to November, for example. And I asked Bob Dylan to come down to the video shoot, you know. And even the director thought I had an imaginary friend.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah, yeah, Bob Dylan coming. He's like, ah, whatever. Bob Dylan ain't even show up for Jacob Dylan. What the hell make you think he's going to show up for you? Man, and Bob shows up at the video shoot. And when Bob Dylan is like, man, you know, you remind me of an old chap that used to play bass with me, you know. Like when he says that to me, that just stays inside of my brain, you know.
Well, you know, the good thing about you, Wyclef, is you're cool, so people want to be associated with you. You know what I mean? And I don't know how you get cool. You have to earn it, but some of it's just a little je ne sais quoi, you know? It's just there.
Je ne sais quoi.
Thank you. That's how you say it. Yeah. Yeah, so no one wants to disappoint Wyclef, and everyone wants to go, yeah, that guy's cool. Yeah, that guy invited me down. I don't know how you get it. Some of it is earned, and some of it is just it, but you got it, baby. Wyclef, you got to meet with Sean Penn about the Haitian National Choir. That's what I'm told.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm told you have to, I'm getting a message saying, oh, man, what a life you have. What a goddamn life. The name of the book, Purpose, it is an immigrant's story. Who do you hope reads this book? Well, not who do you hope, but what do you hope people get from this book?
I hope they get triumph. No matter what you think you're going through, somebody is going through something worse. Like when you was comparing it from, you know, what is the hut compared to how we living here? And sometimes we hear and we complaining about we need more work or we don't have something to eat today, you know. Just always know that it's all right for us here because somebody else got it worse, you know. You
could be eating dirt and riding a donkey. Mm-hmm. Book, by the way, available on Amazon. And one of the things that's nice, speaking of one door shuts, another opens, I would have never started this and had this studio. I didn't lose my radio job, and now it's coming on 4 years, never looked back. And when people support this show, when they go to buy your book off of Amazon, mm-hmm. they go to my website and they click on the Amazon banner, pow.
Wow.
We get to wet our beaks as well. So you can help Wyclef. You can get his book. You can get some knowledge. And you can give us a little love as well. The ebook has 5 songs and videos, by the way. So you want to check out the ebook version of Purpose as well. Wyclef, this is it's been fun, man.
It's been really cool. You're a cool dude, man. Your collection is rad, man. This is the best interview because this is the coolest interview. When I show up, first thing I do, go to the garage and see the cars.
he's a genius, everybody. All right, so until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Wyclef Jean saying mahalo.